We started recording?
Yeah, started recording.
You excited?
Not really. Let's not talk about it. Let's not talk about it.
No, we have to focus on our podcast. Don't worry about the rest. How exciting is our podcast?
It's very exciting. We've got 6,000 downloads and was it people writing in from international?
International. We have to do a couple of shout outs, okay?
Please do.
So we're so excited to be getting emails from all over the world. And we've got Percy Samuel from New Zealand. John Apollon from Hutt Hospital in Wellington, New Zealand.
Thanks
so much for your emails.
And the corrections as well. You know how we've been, that last episode was Miller's anesthesia proven wrong by Dr. Stante. And then in the notes, I've actually written, in the notes for the one of the next ones, I've actually written the wrong thing.
All right.
I've messed up.
Yes.
Umbilical artery and intrinsic artery. So thank you, Jono.
You know what? We should have a prize for listeners who come in and correct our work. How about that?
Yeah, that'd actually be pretty good. But then there'd be so many people trying to correct us. I don't want to go through all that.
All right. We'll do a non-monetary prize then.
Yeah. Our respect.
And then we've got, who else do we have?
Yeah, who else?
Who's written in? I'm going to let you say this guy's name because I can't.
Yep, Gihan Hapuarachi.
Yes.
Great Sri Lankan name.
He drives from the Gold Coast to Brisbane for his work, and he listens to us in the car. And then a special shout out to Ellie Nelson, all the way from Exeter in the United Kingdom. Thank you so much, Ellie, for listening to us all the way in the UK. We really appreciate your support. And then last, we've got Nathan Blakely from WA, who emailed us to say that apparently we're hitting the waves in WA. And for all those who don't know, I'm actually from WA. I went to Aquinas College.
I don't remember ever knowing that.
Yeah, well, you learn something new about me every day. So yep. Went to Aquinas College and came to Melbourne Uni in 1999 and been in Melbourne since then.
Oh, very nice. Yep. I always thought you were a bit western suburbs, but I didn't realize that far west.
Well, I do work in the west.
That's right.
So that's as much west as I
know. That's good. Okay, let's crack on. So thank you very much. Welcome everybody to another episode of Anesthesia Coffee Break. I'm Lahiru.
And I'm Stan.
And today we're going to talk about categorization for this exam. So now that all our candidates this year have sat the written, it's probably worthwhile making the next few episodes Viva focused.
And this advice has really come from Nathan, who wrote us an email and really appreciated when we did the Viva. So what we thought we would do is, or what Lahiru is going to do is, have a think about how he's going to categorize topics or really answers in the way that is a good way to introduce when you get that Viva opening statement.
Yeah, that's right. This is kind of an informal thing that I do every time I give my respiratory tutes, and I just go, here's a list of categorized approaches to various topics. And I think this is probably a really worthwhile thing to do. You know, when you get started for this Viva, having all your thoughts categorized in various topics can be really useful for a number of reasons, but we'll get to that in a second.
But first, we're going to have a performance tip from you. So, La, what's your performance tip?
Excellent. So, we mentioned the first law of behavior change a couple of weeks ago, and that's, make something, make it easy. And the inversion of that law, the opposite, is to make it invisible. This is quite obvious, right? If you want to do something that's useful, make it obvious. But if you want to make something not happen, if you want to stop doing a bad habit or bad behavior, just make it as least tempting as possible. So people with high self-control, tend to spend less time in tempting situations, but it's easier to avoid temptation than resist it. So, one of the most practical ways to eliminate bad habits is just to reduce exposure to the cue that causes it or to, to the habit itself. This chapter of Atomic Habits really goes on to say self-control is a short-term strategy. It's not a long-term one. Even the people with the highest self-control still can't control themselves long-term. I've got a few examples of that from my actual first part experience where, I hadn't read this book, but I knew that I so easily when I'm fatigued, just go to TV as a bit of an escape. So I actually disconnected my TV. I was living with a housemate at the time and he's a very nice guy, very agreeable. And he was actually okay with that, which I'm really surprised by. So I disconnected the TV and so I did not watch TV at all for those, months of doing this exam. And I think that was really valuable. But I also think that these days it's far more difficult because, who watches TV anymore? you know, you'd really have to restrict access to YouTube, Netflix, Disney Plus, Stan, any other sites you frequent for distraction. And just imagine all of that time you'll waste on cat videos or whatever your thing is. You need to stop doing that. And the way I did that for myself was to disconnect the TV. But this might be something more complex with some kind of filter for your internet.
It's so true, because I remember studying for my second part exam, and during that time, it was so easy just to go onto the internet and just get distracted with just random YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And you'd find that your time would just be taken up just with doing those bad habits. So yeah, that's a really good idea. So, you know, what would you suggest to someone who is in a situation where temptation is so easily accessible? Like, yeah, what are some of the strategies that you would advise them to make it a lot more difficult so that they're not tempted by it?
The first thing to know is that we've got very little ability to control these circumstances. Just know that the people in Facebook and YouTube, Google, they are just, you know, working with everything to try and get you onto a channel and stay on that channel. Like, that's, they've got people working around the clock on this, paid, you know, to get a multi-million dollar amount. So, you know, if you think you can control yourself, you're probably wrong. Things like just getting off Facebook completely, getting off Instagram completely, is probably a useful thing to do. You know, for myself, you know, I think like everyone else, I'll just check Facebook and then suddenly I'm scrolling through people's, you know, news feeds, just wondering what I'm doing. And so what I've done is I've really restricted my time on Facebook, but I've also taken the Facebook app from my home screen to a few screens later. So it's much harder for me to just naturally remember to do that. And I've done that with all social media as well, because I really want to restrict social media for myself for educational stuff.
That's really good advice, La. So I think, you know, for all of us out there who are starting to prepare now for the part one vivas, and you might find that there will be times when you'll be tempted to do things which will take away from your study time. So the best thing to do is create situations where you're not tempted, okay? Yeah, and really focus. And next couple of weeks, really get those vivas done and get the pass.
If anyone has any suggestions for what they've done to, you know, eliminate distractions, whether it's some kind of IT solution or whatever it is, please write into us at lahiruandstan@gmail.com. We'd love to get your input.
Okay, La. So we're going to start categorization of an answer. No, so before we go with that, why is it important to categorize?
Categorization is a fundamental technique that we use in this exam, but it's also a really, really good technique just for communication in general, especially in complex environments, you know, environments like theater we're always in, where lots of things are happening, lots of things are going wrong. And your ability to communicate effectively, I think, really lends itself well if you categorize. So firstly, you just sound organized and succinct. When you have a categorized answer, you give a complete answer by just saying, say, four categories or four words. I think in my experience, it really establishes good frameworks for clinical practice as well, knowing that, you know, you've just got to check off these four or five things and then you get to your answer, or you get to a place of safety. You get to an answer much quicker in the exam as well if you are able to categorize and then filter through each listed answer. And for this exam, it's often an icebreaker question. The opening question in the viva is often, you know, how would you categorize something? How do you categorize IV induction agents? How do you categorize amino acids was one of the questions in the past. So being able to just quickly make a categorized answer just allows you to move on very quickly.
Okay, so the way we're going to run today's session is I'll ask you a question and then you're going to answer it in a categorized way.
Is absolutely that right? And so I thought I'd give the first example. Most of our examples are going to be the respiratory physiology topics, but like, say, you know, someone asks you, what is the cause of hypertension? As a junior person, you might go, oh, look, maybe it's anaphylaxis, maybe it's volume loss, dehydration, or blood loss. And that sounds like a pretty good answer, but it really negates to mention so many other causes. But imagine if you said an answer that wasn't just picking individual solutions, but you said something like, look, the causes of hypertension are caused essentially by preload, rate, rhythm, contractility issues, and afterload. And then pause in the exam. And then you can filter your answer based on what you've just said. So preload causes include, you know, vena dilation, blood loss, volume loss, dehydration, etc. Rate, easy. Just check the rate. Rhythm, check the rhythm. Contractility, is this an ischemic heart disease patient? Is there valve issues? Is there other cause of obstruction? And then finally, is it afterload? Is it vasodilation? Distributive shock? whatever it is. So suddenly you've given a very complete answer in 1 second, and then depending on how the examiner might respond, they may want more detail into an individual component of that, and then you can say all the detail and get you to your answer quickly. I find this just really works well in the Viva as well as in clinical situations as well.
And this is really such an important skill to have, because it really allows you to cover that breadth of topic and really show the examiner you've got that breadth of knowledge. Because one of the things, as you've pointed out, is that when I do trial Vivas for candidates, they've got the knowledge, but what they'll do is they'll just talk on one topic for that whole minute. Whereas, as you said, there's a whole breadth that you actually need to cover, and it's often good just to list the main subjects, and then when questioned further, you can go deeper into detail.
Exactly.
All right. So the first one is, what stimulates respiratory rate?
Excellent. So in my answer, again, I'd categorize them. I'd prioritize my answer first as well as giving a category. So, you know, the most important factors include PaCO2, or the CO2 tension in the blood, oxygen tension in the blood, and maybe pH. And then there's other factors. These are, you know, less important generally speaking, but they are lung factors, cortical factors, hormonal factors, and this extra thing, which is exercise. If I was to go into more detail, then in those lung factors, there's J receptors, stretch receptors, and irritant receptors. The cortical is emotional issues, voluntary control. Hormonal is essentially pregnancy, and then exercise is its own extra thing. For this answer, after I categorize, then I can go into more detail for the main subject points, which is the CO2, oxygen, and pH. So I thought that's just a good way, good warm-up way of, you know, getting through all of your answer very quickly, knowing that you can go into more detail about the important stuff, which is CO2 and oxygen.
Correct. And that would be a natural lead-on for an examiner. And the most obvious thing that they would explore on is the PaCO2 and PO2. And you'll find that when you ask these questions to candidates, that's all they'll talk about. But you have already mentioned so much other things. You know, you mentioned the lung, cortical, hormonal, exercise. And it's so much more than just the important ones, which are PaCO2, PaO2, pH. So that's a really good, solid opening statement. Beautiful. Opening categorical statement.
That's right.
All right. So the next one I'm going to ask you is, what are the causes of an increased AA gradient?
Yeah, great. So this is actually a smaller part of the causes of low PaO2 or hypoxemia. And so I just go in and say, well, the main causes are VQ mismatch, shunt, and diffusion abnormality. It's very quick, but I can go into far more detail about each of those as the examiner requires.
And then the next one I'm going to ask you is, what are the causes of low partial pressure of oxygen?
So the causes of hypoxemia, or low PaO2, are decreased FI, or the partial pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere, VQ mismatch, shunt, hypoventilation, and diffusion abnormality. This will be one of the most common questions you might be asked, but also one of the most common scenarios in real life as well. You know, if you think of hypotension and hypoxemia as the most common problems you'll get during clinical anesthesia, your ability to answer those questions succinctly and have differentials for each of those points is absolutely mandatory. Just to give more detail maybe about those, FiO2, great. I'll just check the FI through the gas analyzer, ensure my oxygen is up to 100%. VQ is mismatched. This is often with pre-existing lung disease. I can optimize my cardiac output to ensure there's appropriate VQ matching throughout the lung. Shunt, there's a lot of causes of shunt, so I might actually leave that for last. Hyperventilation, just ensuring that there's good ventilation, minute ventilation, and oxygen delivery to the alveolus. Diffusion abnormality is often a pre-existing thing as well, and so optimizing the patient's existing disease state is most useful. With shunt, and we've gone through this a few times before in other topics, but with shunt, essentially I'm thinking of all the causes of shunt in this setting, which include common things like, you know, bronchospasm, endobronchial intubation, atelectasis, sputum plugging, but as well as a pneumothorax or tension pneumothorax, APO, and any kind of aspiration as well.
That's fantastic. And just to recap for the audience, mm-hmm. So we've talked about the increase in AA gradient, and after that, we've talked about the causes of low PaO2.
Yes.
And so just to also think about it a different way is that the causes of low PaO2, but with a normal AA gradient, would be a low FiO2.
Yes.
And hypoventilation.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yep. So the ones that increase your AA gradient, okay, are the other causes. So VQ mismatch, shunt, diffusion impairment, which you mentioned in the first one. So that's I really like that.
Excellent.
Okay, so the next one is, what are the causes of hypercapnia?
Yeah, great. Again, a really common scenario. Every time I look at that CO2 level, whether it's falling or rising, I think about this equation. So PaCO2 is proportional to CO2 production over alveolar ventilation or elimination of CO2, which is often alveolar ventilation. So PaCO2 proportional to CO2 production over alveolar ventilation or elimination of CO2. And then I'd go into more detail. So CO2 production, this is almost, you know, universally standard. It's about the patient's existing metabolic state, the kind of substrate they're using, which is in a very niche thing. But if you're, you know, a full carbohydrate diet, it's different to a full fat or full protein diet. But let's say the substrate is minimally important in that. And then finally, in the anesthetic circuit, it could be CO2 rebreathing. Now, so I've gone through CO2 production and all of the factors that can affect that, and might even mention that the metabolic stuff then, so I'm now going into metabolic, this is increased in things like malignant hypothermia in our situation, maybe thyrotoxicosis or sepsis. The next part of that is alveolar ventilation or elimination of CO2. And again, there's a whole bunch of things. So I think of this as the patient who has, you know, less ventilation for whatever reason. And it could be due to simply underventilating them because they're a paralyzed patient that I'm underventilating. Or if they're spontaneously ventilating or a non-anesthetic patient, it could be anywhere from your upper motor neuron all the way down to your lung itself. So I think of all the sections where ventilation might be compromised. This is in upper motor neuron stroke issues, lower motor neuron issues, which often, you know, nerve damage type things or existing conditions. Neuromuscular junction issues makes me think of pathology at that junction, myasthenia gravis, and residual curization with a muscle relaxant. Then finally, chest wall issues, you know, SRs or any kind of circumferential burns or restrictive chest wall defects. And finally, it can be impaired in the anesthetic setting with VQ mismatch. That's essentially dead space where ventilation isn't increased to compensate for that. Diffusion abnormalia and shunt may also minimally affect that. Interestingly, in the anesthetic circuit, if you have a T-piece type circuit, having low flows of gas will also prevent the elimination of CO2. So often with pediatric circuits, you actually need to have your fresh gas flow pretty high to eliminate that CO2, regardless of what your alveolar ventilation is.
Now, it's going to be a bit contentious.
Yep.
But there is a question about VQ mismatch, diffusion, and shunt in terms of whether that actually increases your
exactly.
CO2.
That's right. And so, yeah, CO2 elimination, if the patient has, you know, is able to breathe for themselves without, you know, any other factors affecting them, CO2 is so tightly controlled by chemoreceptors that minute ventilation will just be increased. So that will play a very minimal part of it. And that's like a bit of a side note that if there is issues with, you know, the response to CO2, then maybe that could affect it. But I wouldn't put that in bold letters.
Great. And then how about the carriage of carbon dioxide in blood?
Oh, this was really just a table, and I just wanted to make sure that I remembered this, but yeah. So it's, you know, bicarb, carbamino, and dissolved. These are the ways that CO2 is carried in the blood. And then there's a table showing the rough proportions and the arteriovenous difference. So what we'll do, and we'll have another section in our podcast, which we'll go over CO2 carriage. But just to remember, it's bicarbonate is the majority, carbamino compounds and dissolved. And the interesting thing is the arteriovenous difference is disproportionately contributed to by these carbamino compounds. So that's just an interesting point that we'll develop on in later podcasts.
Yeah. And that's an important point, is that this is the table you have in West. Mm. And what you described is that venous carriage, and it's the arteriovenous difference. What is the carriage that accounts for the arteriovenous difference? And a lot of candidates will get confused because they'll think it's the arterial carriage.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
So just make sure that you understand that point, that the second column is the arteriovenous difference. So how about what are the changes to 2,3 DPG?
Yeah, this is an interesting, quite a very specific question in otherwise a pretty broad respiratory physiology topic. But yeah, 2,3 DPG is really important for unloading of oxygen, especially at the tissue level. And so when I think about the factors that affect this, I think of factors that decrease oxygen, cardiovascular factors, and other. So for decreased oxygen, in more detail, COAD, altitude, exercise, pregnancy, and alkalosis. These can affect oxygen, therefore affect 2,3 DPG. And then cardiovascular factors include anemia, and other factors include stored blood. So 2,3 DPG is almost always lacking in stored blood.
The audience might ask, how does, and I think you You were thinking about it too. You were thinking about it too. How does alkalosis reduce your PaO2? So you're right in terms of it is a factor, but I don't think it's related to the decrease in oxygen. That you do get the alkalosis, and the alkalosis actually increases your 2,3 DPG as a negative feedback mechanism to limit the left shift that you get on the oxygen dissociation curve. So that was, so it's correct. It's meant to be there, but I don't think it's meant to be under oxygen.
Exactly.
What is venous admixture? It's the amount of mixed venous blood that needs to be added to end capillary blood to see the observed difference in PO2 between arterial and end capillary.
That's perfect. That's exactly right. So the causes of venous admixture, again, categorizing this really helps to understand both or all the pathologies of this or pathogenesis of this. So there's true shunt and then VQ mismatch. True shunt can be physiological or pathological. Physiological in more detail is the existing bronchial veins that, you know, essentially supply the bronchi with oxygenated blood, and that then drains into systemic circulation, bypassing oxygenation in the lungs, and also the Thebesian veins. And so these are the vessels, everyone's heard of this, when they look at venous admixture, everyone talks about these veins. They're veins that really don't come up in any other circumstance, but vessels or veins embedded in the walls of the heart itself, and they drain the myocardium, and they present in all the four heart chambers.
So they drain it into the left atrium. That's very important.
Okay, good. Exactly, because it's got to bypass the lungs.
Correct.
Good. That's the physiological shunt, then there's pathological shunt. So often these are all the other things that I've already mentioned in the previous hypoxemia section, but atelectasis, consolidation, but also AV malformations, right to left shunt, malignancies can have these issues as well as Eisenmenger syndrome. And finally, VQ mismatch. So VQ's mismatch is often, you know, before you do anesthetics and study for your first part, it really isn't something that people think about, you know, deeply, but it's just the fact that every single alveolus has a different VQ ratio, where you get very high VQ ratios at the apex of the lung and low VQ ratios at the bottom, at the base of the lung. And when you combine all of these, you know, inadequate VQ mismatched segments or alveoli, pulmonary capillary, you know, little units, you get little amounts of non-perfectly, you know, oxygenated blood. These all will sum up to add a certain amount of venous admixture when they're added back into the circulation. That's probably the best way I can explain it. No lung unit is absolutely ideal because of the changing VQ ratios, and that will contribute to a not sufficiently oxygenated blood, which then adds into the systemic circulation.
And I think that's the other important thing that you've actually noted here is that venous admixture is not shunt. It's shunt and VQ mismatch. And so it's very important to make that distinction that the two pathologies are different. Mm-hmm. And what venous admixture does is that it takes all that VQ mismatch and converts that to a virtual shunt. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're right in terms of what you describe. And the isoshunt diagram that you'll see in NUNS shows you what the difference is in terms that with a VQ mismatch, you're able to correct the oxygenation with an increase in FiO2, but with a true shunt, especially with shunts that are more than 30%, you'll be unable to correct the PaO2 with increasing FiO2.
Yeah, excellent.
All right, so the next one I'm going to ask you is airways. What is airways resistance, or what contributes to airways resistance?
Yeah, good. I find this one actually very difficult to categorize because, you know, it seems like you've got factors in every direction. So I just chose this as a system, and everyone will choose a different system as long as you, you know, I guess, adhere to it, memorize it, and understand it really well. And the way I've decided to categorize this is the factors that affect airways resistance is the flow factors, which is either laminar flow or turbulent flow, lung volumes, and then ultimately the endotracheal tube in the anesthesia circumstance and other attachments to the circuit. But the biggest part of this really in laminar flow is the fact that the radius contributes disproportionately to the amount of resistance that you're going to have. And that's due to the Hagen-Purcell equation. So there's radius, there's length, and then there's viscosity as per this equation. But radius is by far the biggest factor because it multiplies any reduction in your radius has a, you know, multiplication factor for how much the resistance increases. After radius, I then think about all the things that could affect it, drugs, histamine, and disease states like asthma or inflammation, infection, neoplasms, dynamic airway compression, neural effects. So, you know, any kind of sympathetic stimulation will increase radius, and you know, cholinergic type things, histamine will decrease. CO2 as a gas dilates the bronchioles, and then any foreign bodies as well will decrease the radius. Length and viscosity are probably more self-explanatory, but you can always go into detail using the Hagen-Purcell equation for that as well. Now with turbulent flow, it again, Nunn's has a number of very complicated equations, which are probably worth just quickly memorizing and writing down. But essentially, flow and respiratory rate affect turbulence and then increases resistance, the density of the gas, and again, the radius to, again, a factor of 5 or so increases the resistance with turbulent flow. So there it is, flow factors, so laminar flow or turbulent flow, lung volumes, and the endotracheal tube and other attachments.
And that's a great summary of airways resistance. Now, another very common question is, what are the factors affecting lung compliance?
Great. So lung compliance, I think of these categories, lung factors, the chest wall factors, and then dynamic compliance as an extra factor. The lung factors include volume, the elastic components of the lung, and surfactant. And then volume, I can just pretty much summarize that as the body size of the individual, any disease states like atelectasis, edema, consolidation, whether they've had a lobectomy or pneumonectomy as well, gravity, and age. Elastic factors include disease states like emphysema, which increase compliance, and then disease states like fibrosis, edema, or AIDS that decrease compliance. And then surfactant is obviously really important for lung compliance. Any decrease with surfactant occurs in, you know, infant respiratory distress syndrome, as well as in pulmonary embolism as well. And then chest wall factors, these are probably easier to think about conceptually, you know, things with the chest wall, deformities, kyphoscoliosis, ankylosing spondylitis, and then anything that puts, I guess, pressure or increases the weight on the diaphragm, supine positioning, pregnancy, obesity. Finally, dynamic compliance. So there's always increased airways resistance with things like bronchoconstriction. And then, you know, I might invoke the fact that time constants also play a part in dynamic compliance.
Great. And then another very common question is, what are the factors that affect functional residual capacity?
Yes, again, this I can divide it into chest wall factors, lung factors, airways resistance factors, which can lead to dynamic hyperinflation, and the presence of PEEP. And so, as you can see, there's a bit of overlap with a few of these topics, which makes it a lot easier to memorize. So chest wall factors include diaphragm, so again, pregnancy, abdominal mass, posture, anesthesia, burns, and chest wall things, ankylosing spondylitis, kyphoscoliosis. Lung factors include, again, emphysema and pulmonary edema or ARDS. And so just to recap, FRC, think of all the factors that affect your chest wall and its ability to recoil outwards, all the lung factors that affect, you know, its ability to recoil inwards, and then any kind of dynamic hyperinflation or the administration of PEEP to your airway.
Great. And then the next one is, what are the factors affecting dead space?
Essentially, I've looked at this as anatomic factors or alveolar factors. And again, there'll be lots of ways you can kind of conceptualize this, but I've just chosen this as a method. So there's individual things anatomically, which is age, size of the patient, the gender of the patient, positional factors, you know, having supine positioning or flexion of the head. Then there's drugs, bronchodilators, anesthetic gas that dilate, and all the apparatus dead space, which is from the endotracheal tube and any other attachments up to the Y-piece. The alveolar factors are essentially West Zone 1 and pulmonary embolism. So if I have increased West Zone 1, which can be, you know, essentially those parts of the alveoli that are ventilated but not perfused, and this can be caused due to hypotension or high pressures with IPPV and also erect posture. Often this happens in more of the disease states, really, and with higher pressures in ventilating a patient under anesthesia.
Oh, great. And so the addition of anatomical and alveolar dead space will give you physiological dead space.
Exactly. That's right.
And we measure physiological dead space using the Bohr equation.
Excellent.
Yep. Okay. And then we might go through that on a future episode. Okay.
Absolutely.
But that's how the examiners would explore your knowledge, with a good categorization of the main headings. And then we'll go down each one individually. Yep.
Sorry. And to think about it, sometimes, you know, really what you're doing is you're able to list these things that you just memorized. You've got all these lists that you memorized. I can imagine you just give the examiner confidence that you know what you're talking about. You've got this sharp, categorized answer that they can then go into the real meat of the question, which is, tell me about Bohr's equation. You know, yes. And suddenly you've got to talk about something quite in detail that's not just a bit of understanding here and there.
Correct. And remember that your Viva is only 5 minutes. So when you get a introductory question and you can answer that in 30 seconds, which covers all the main points, I can tell you when I get that from a candidate, I'll say that, you know, they've scored a basic pass already. Yeah. And everything I'm going to do now in terms of exploring each of their ideas just adds on to their mark. Mm. All right. So next one is what are the factors affecting worker breathing?
Now, what I love about this is worker breathing really encompasses a lot of other factors, such as compliance factors and, you know, the airways resistance stuff. So you've already memorized this and now you're just going to load these factors into another categorization. So work of breathing, these are elastic factors and non-elastic factors that affect it. These elastic factors are essentially compliance factors, factors affecting the lung and the chest wall. And we've already gone through that. The lung includes surfactant, anything that affects the elasticity of the lung, disease states and lung volumes, and then chest wall issues, you know, the diaphragm, ankylosing spondylitis, kyphoscoliosis, burns, whatever it is. And you can rattle off a lot of different things, probably off the cuff, that would affect your chest wall. And the non-elastic factors, these are airways resistance and tissue resistance factors. Airways resistance was, again, the way I categorized it, flow. Is it laminar or turbulent flow? Lung volumes and the endotracheal tube. And then tissue resistance is the extra thing we add to the non-elastic factors. And this is the friction associated with viscoelastic deformation at the pleural, chest wall, and abdominal interface. So a bit of a you know, load of words there, but important as a definition to memorize.
And then lastly, what are the factors that affect pulmonary vascular resistance?
Right. So, yep, another big question and with a lot of detail that can go into it. So I think of pulmonary artery pressure factors, lung volume factors, hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction, as well as drugs, disease states, and then neural, humeral, and then viscosity issues. So there's, again, so many things involved with pulmonary vascular resistance. You know, you're thinking of the pulmonary structures itself and the way that lung volumes affect it, as well as the way all of these other things, drugs, disease, neural, humeral viscosity affects things like the radius. So just to go through that in a bit more detail, pulmonary artery pressure changes with increased cardiac output, with gravity, and with West zones. Lung volume, so at FRC, pulmonary vascular resistance is at its minimum. Hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction is another factor that's obviously important in anesthesia because volatile gas decreases this innate ability of the lung to vasoconstrict the hypoxic segments. Then there's drugs. So nitric oxide, GTN, milrinone, volatiles, these all affect the radius of your vessels. Disease states, COPD, can also affect this. And then knowing a few of the neural, humeral, and viscosity factors. So neural factors, alpha-1 agonism, increases resistance, whereas B2 decreases the resistance of your pulmonary vasculature. Humeral factors such as eicosanoids, serotonin, catecholamines increase the pulmonary vascular resistance. And then finally, increased viscosity. So increase in your hemoglobin levels, increasing viscosity, increasing hematocrit, this can increase the resistance as well.
La Hiro, you've done a fantastic job. You've covered a lot of topics and we've created a lot of good categorized summary statements, or rather categorized introductory statements to opening Viva questions.
Yeah, imagine doing that for every topic: cardiovascular, renal, neural, pharmacology. And I think that's one thing that we all eventually do. I'd say now that you're starting to study for this Viva, just get this stuff. This is kind of fun to do. Get in your groups, just talk about how each of you categorizes it, and then just get onto quizzing each other, memorizing. You want that first, like you said, the first answer you give your examiners, you want it to be so sharp that they just go, yeah, this person's ready for a pass. Yeah, they've got
exactly.
This.
And I think a good thing to do is actually to look at your short answer questions and actually think about how you would actually create an introductory statement for it as a Viva STEM. Hmm. So now it's going to be changed in terms of about the way you sort of think about this exam now, because now it's going to be a very interactive spoken language exam. So a way to sort of practice is that if you get a short answer question, just pick it out of a hat, you know, ask someone about it, and then just get them just to give you a 30 to 45 seconds introductory statement and see how you go with that.
That's pretty good. And maybe you can make it like a bit of a game where, you know, the first person to get all of them, I don't know, gets a round of coffees for...
should sponsor that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Hey, so I will put all of my categorized answers in either the transcript or the story notes, depending on how much space we've got in that. But yeah, I think that's a great way to end this. So thanks again. Thanks very much for listening. And please share and subscribe to our podcast and let us know. Please let us know if there's anything else you want. And we'd be really happy. We'd love doing this. It's actually quite a bit of fun. It's really, really fun getting the feedback as well and just seeing how far this actually reaches. So it's all very new to us and very exciting. And thanks for being part of this. See you later.